Welcome to the 50th episode of Buff Speak. Man, I've had a lot of fun the last 3 years getting to visit with some of the thought leaders in the area and pick their brains. Today, we're going to have a special issue to commemorate 50 different episodes. So roll the intro. You're listening to Buff Speak, the official podcast of the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University. I am Dr. Nick Gerlich, your host, as we meet up with the thought leaders making an impact today. My guest today is Dr. Eric Hoffman, the Pickens Professor of Economics. How's that for some alliteration there? And if you recognize the name, it's because Eric has been on the show twice before, once solo and once with some of his econ colleagues. He's very informed, very articulate, and our goal today is to explore some of the biggest issues facing all of us in the news and in the economy. And to be fair, these are kind of controversial topics, but we are going to approach them like academics should. And we'll talk about the pros and cons of each, the ins and the outs, and then you can form your own opinion. Welcome back to the show, Eric.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Today, we're going to look at two I's and one T. We're gonna hit on interest, inflation, and tariffs. And we're gonna start out with the interest rates right off the top here. This has long been a bone of contention among many because it's made it pretty difficult to be able to borrow money to purchase a house. Housing prices have grown exponentially in the last 4 or 5 decades. And right now, the current interest rate is about 6.5%. And I've seen that economists predict it's probably going to drop into the low sixes by the end of this year and on into 2026. But at the end of the day, it really all boils down to whatever the Fed decides to do. But as in all things related to economics, everything's related, right? It's not like they're just going to change interest rates because they feel like it. They're only going to do it if they see change in other things. So, Eric, what are your thoughts on the interest rate here? 6.5%, that sounds daunting. And I know some folks are still doing it. I see new houses being built, maybe not quite the same volume as they were a few years ago, but they're still being built. People are still buying and selling, but it's not like it was before.
No, you're absolutely right. I think the first thing that you said hits the nail on the head there. Everything is interrelated. So if you want to know what's going to happen with interest rates, we're going to have to take a look at what's going to happen with inflation. And if we want to know what goes on with inflation, well, I think we're sort of living in an uncertain environment at this point. So anybody who tells you that they know with certainty what's going to happen with interest rates and inflation probably doesn't know what they're talking about. I certainly am sort of waiting to see how this entire year is going to unfold in terms of these important economic variables.
Well, it's certainly a great time to have been locked in several years ago, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And enjoying a low rate. I mean, during COVID, rates went, they cratered. And that would have been the time, obviously. But we can't always see those things in the crystal ball, can we?
No, we can't. And I think a lot of people were hoping that after the inflationary period of post-COVID, inflation was sort of creeping down, has crept down, not yet to the point where the Fed is comfortable, but nevertheless, to a more normal level. And people were hoping for some rate cuts here, which would sort of boost the economy back up. But now we have some sort of external inflationary pressures that might prevent the Federal Reserve from doing so. And we're going to see how that unfolds here. And of course, just to give everybody a background, the Federal Reserve is mainly concerned with, well, they're concerned with a lot of things, but in the context of our discussion, they're going to be concerned with inflation. And so the idea is if inflation gets too high, what they can do is they have ways of manipulating the money supply so that they can increase interest rates, which will in turn slow down economic activity and therefore get inflation back under manageable levels. And the reverse can be done as well, where if inflation is low and the economy needs a boost, they can lower interest rates, making it easier for businesses to start up and lend and people to buy houses and buy cars, get the economy going, and sort of give the economy a boost. So that's what we're going to be keeping an eye on here to see what the Federal Reserve and how they react to the economic conditions.
Now, if you want to buy a new car, interest rates are about 7.5%, but that's only for those with extremely high FICO scores, credit ratings.
Right, right.
If you've got a miserable credit rating or no credit rating, you're going to be looking at 13 to 15% interest on a new car. And with the average price of a new car running about $45,000, you can only imagine what those payments are going to be like.
Yeah, that's probably going to be prohibitive for a lot of people, unfortunately. And that's why everybody's crossing their fingers that maybe we're going to get a few rate cuts down the road here. But again, we'll see. And I know that mortgage rates are also pretty high these days.
So I did a little digging back into the past because I grew up through a lot of this stuff here and actually bought a house when interest rates were considerably higher. But in 1980, the interest rate on a mortgage was 16.5%.
And these days, that would be considered astronomical.
Yeah. Can you imagine what your house payments would have been like?
Yeah.
Holy cow. By 1989, that's when I bought my house. The interest rate was down to 10.5%.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody was complaining back then.
Right.
They were all thinking, wow, this is great, man. Sure. It's dropped 6 percentage points. We're in, man. This is great. Let's all go buy a house. I actually was able to get mine at 9.5% because it was owner financed. And the guy, well, we cut out the middleman basically. And that, you know, when you can shave a point off, that's good, right? I mean,
yeah.
I save money. And I thought I was getting the deal of the century there.
And I know a lot of people post-COVID bought their houses at around between 3 and 4%. And,
yeah, isn't that crazy?
And now I think the expectations are set that people are going to, they're holding off buying a house until they see rates like that again. But I don't know if we're going to see rates like that again.
With 6.5% and also the ability of anybody to just Google this and see what it was like, 35 years ago, why are people upset about only 6.5%?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think housing and the economy is a big issue that we need to talk about because not only do housing prices, are they on the upper end these days, or at least perceived to be so? I think housing is an issue just about everywhere in the developed world, but paired with high interest rates, because usually, you know, if prices are low, you can stomach a high interest rate, and if interest rates are low, then a little bit higher on the price. But it seems that most people have the perception, which very possibly is true, that you have high prices and high interest rates, which makes it difficult to get into a house. I've
heard a lot of people say and criticize that one of the main reasons that the price of housing has gone up so much is because there is a shortage of houses to either purchase or rent.
Right.
And we can blame the wealthiest generation ever, that would be mine, the baby boomers, for buying more than one house. They've
sure.
got two houses or
yeah.
three houses, or they're turning them into Airbnbs.
Right.
But in the process, what they're doing is taking houses off the market for
that's
those
right.
for those people who just need a first house.
Right.
And that's a problem. Right now, I've seen estimates as high as 7 or 8 million new houses that are needed to be built just to meet demand.
Yeah. And one of the other factors is what we just talked about. A lot of those people who bought their houses at 3%, they're not going to be willing to move and offer their house on the market unless they can get comparable rates, right? And so that sort of locks in that segment unless prices really come down. That sort of eats up some sort of housing supply in that regard.
And what about just basic consumer debt? I mean, like we said, it's all related. So if the interest rate for mortgages is 6.5 and cars start at 7.5 and go on up, what's it like for credit cards?
Yeah, that's doesn't make it easy, does it?
No. I mean, I've heard of 30%.
Yeah, right.
And it doesn't take long for somebody not to just get behind, but just never be able to crawl out. It would take a lifetime of making monthly payments to ever pay it off.
No, I know. And I think, and that's why these conversations are very timely now, because we seem like we're in a transitionary period, and we could be entering a new era of, I don't want to say, people always make these grand announcements. We're in a new era of economics, but I think at least that's a perception. And so with topics like this, it's important to sort of, that's why you should take Econ 101 to understand these sorts of topics.
And 102.
And 102, of course. Yes, naturally.
Our country is built upon the idea of checks and balances, so that there really is no one person or entity that rules everything. And so the Fed really doesn't answer to the president.
Right. They are semi-independent. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way they work is carried out through a private manner in the private banks, but they are also an independent entity. There's some presidential appointments that go on with the board, but other than that, they have very long terms, which shields them from political influence. And this is something I ask in my class. It's an ethical question in some sense. How independent should the Federal Reserve be from the government? Right. And on one hand, you'd say, well, these people are running this. They're controlling interest rates, or they're influencing interest rates. That's our economy. We should have a lot of say-so. The elected officials should have a lot of influence in this regard. But on the other hand, the political pressure on politicians is to always have an economy that's booming, right? If you want to get reelected, then what you have to do is, boom, make the economy grow, right? And look what I did to the economy. Great for my reelection. But the problem with that is the long run view of what happens when you just make the economy boom is it piles on the inflation, and the initial boom that you might have sort of contracts back down to normal levels. But what you get at the end of the day is just inflation on inflation on inflation. And normally when a politician is out of office, be it a whatever politician we might be talking about, they don't have to deal with the long-term consequences. And that's why we give the central bank the independence that it does.
So it has. What's it going to take for the Fed to reduce rates the next time they meet?
They're going to have to see and be convinced that inflation is on a lower path, a lower trend. And I don't know. I'm not in on those discussions. There's a lot of modeling that goes on and a lot of data. There's Federal Reserve banks from San Francisco to D.C., there's one in Dallas, Kansas City, St. Louis. All of these Federal Reserve banks, they come together and they give their regional reports on what's going on in their region of the economy. And they all come together. This is happening in the West. This is happening in Texas. This is happening in Minnesota. And they have to agree on what sort of rates are best for the country. And they'll make those decisions. And after all these discussions, they might say, oh, we're going to do something, make a half of a percent of a change, right? And so it's very measured, it's very thought out, it's very deliberate, it's very information driven and informed.
Now, the majority of the time when they do drop the rates, it's only 25 basis points. Right. That's a quarter of one percentage point. That's, we're shaving the ice here pretty thin.
Yeah.
But the stock market loves this kind of stuff. Investors are always, they're all ears when the Fed is about to talk.
The market loves lower interest rates because that drives business, that drives investment. And if you can invest when a company's growing and, that's great. That's great for stock market returns. And I think a lot of what's going on now is just the uncertainty in the economy. Because if you are an investor and you're thinking about whether you're going to invest or not invest, and you see uncertainty, well, I'm not going to invest in an uncertain situation. I'd rather hold my money, wait until I can see some certainty in the market, and then invest, And so I think that's what's sort of spooking investors these days.
Now, I've heard about some markets around the country starting to go down just a little bit, like in the Tampa area. Mm-hmm. And I've heard about it in Austin and maybe even some flattening in the Dallas area. What's it going to take to get those 7 or 8 million new houses, though, that could actually bring some stability to the price of houses and maybe even exert a little downward pressure?
I'm sort of speaking out of my area of expertise here. But as far as I see things, I do think it's an issue on the cost side of housing. I think it's just become more expensive to build houses. And I think we just need to get those costs down and create a business environment where it's profitable to increase that supply of housing.
And what kinds of houses do you think are going to be built in the next few years? Because the trend ever since the 1950s has been bigger, mm-hmm. bigger houses. And now a typical new house is about 2,600 square feet. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of house.
It is.
It doesn't count the 2 or 3 car garage. And for another 10% of us, it doesn't count for the offsite storage that we have to rent for all the junk that we have. Because as I've told my students through the years, your stuff will always meet or exceed your available space to store it.
Of course.
We're Americans.
Yes.
You know, we're a consumer-based society. But if it means we build smaller houses to try to get the housing price down, do you think that's a possibility?
I think it sounds like a good strategy. I think ultimately, just at the end of the day, in everything economics, the market is going to dictate what they want. And I'm not on that side of the economy, but I don't know. Again, probably in these metro areas, you'll probably see the smaller units. But again, it really depends on where supply meets demand on these things. So we'll see.
Yeah, there's a new housing development going in about 4 miles west of Canyon here along Highway 60. And so far, they've got 19 houses that have come out of the ground in various stages of completion. No residents yet, but this new development is going to be all about medium and smaller sized houses. They'll be more affordable, and so maybe able to help people who are looking for that first house to be able to move in. The ripple through effects are pretty big. If you have a smaller house, you need less stuff, right? Less furniture.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'd be interested to see how that plays out. And it's interesting that it's happening here in the local area. And I think a lot of people will be keeping their eyes on whether this is a trend that develops and maybe ripples out through other places in the country.
Do you see maybe almost an anti-consumerist era coming for the U.S. in which we were just trying to spend less and have less stuff?
That's a good question. I don't know if I see sort of these larger macroeconomic tendencies of being less consumerist. I think I do see people wanting to get into housing, and if that means that they're going to have to scale back elsewhere, that might happen. And I do see a lot of people trying to get into housing that just simply can't. And I'm hoping, just from a purely human perspective, I'm hoping that, you know, things improve in this market.
Well, if there's anything that symbolizes the American dream, it's home ownership.
That's right.
You've got your little house in the suburbs. You've got a car or two in the garage, you got a front yard, you got a backyard, you've got a family. I mean, this was what it was all about in the 1950s, the post-World War II economic boom. That was, you know, those were some of the greatest years ever in American
history. The American dream.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
We were living it.
Yeah. No, but I think you're right. I think things have changed in that regard. The big question is, can we get back to that? And that's the big question mark. I'm hopeful that we can. I'm hopeful that we can, but we'll see.
And related to the price of borrowing money is the rate of interest we can earn for saving it. What are your thoughts on this right now? That always seems to lag a little bit. It's never quite as much as it costs to borrow it because the bank has to make money, right?
There has to be a profit margin there for the bank, right?
And what kind of rates of return do you think are necessary to motivate people to really save? Because we've been able to buy CDs 4.5%, 5% the last couple of years. It's come down just a few ticks since then. But I started to see people getting interested in some long-term saving instruments.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's going to also depend on the opportunity costs that they have to invest elsewhere. I am seeing, due to this electronic gate, whatever you want to call it, I think it started with the Robin Hood phenomenon. People are just more investing conscious. They're more aware of where they can stick their money and the returns on investment that they can get. I'm not sure exactly what rate that's going to take to get them to save more in this context, but I do think people are certainly more more susceptible, they're paying attention more to these sorts of things that are happening.
And I know some people who have purchased a house in the last couple of years during this era of relatively higher rates. I know what they're all thinking. As soon as rates go down,
right,
I'm going to do a refi. How much does it need to come down to make it worth it?
Yeah, that's a good question. Like I said earlier, I think a lot of people bought at a very low interest rate, relatively speaking, to probably what we're going to see in the future. So I don't know if they have to come down exactly that far, but yeah, I don't know. We'll see.
Do you have any idea about what percent of a family or a household should be spending on housing so that they can keep up with everything else and not go broke?
I think it's recommended somewhere around 25-30%. I'm not a personal financial expert here, but I think that's considered normal. And it becomes harder to balance, again, in an inflationary environment where you have grocery bills going up, where you have car prices going up and all these things going up, and you want to be able to balance your budget at the end of the week. So that might change. We'll see.
When we come back, we're going to take a look at tariffs, and we've got lots of things to explore with this one. This is probably the most contentious issue of the day.
Blogs come in all shapes and sizes these days, and in more cases than not, it's just someone complaining about something. Rare Indeed is the blog that actually dives into the business and economics events of the day. ProfSpeak.com, the official blog of the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University, is just that. With a staff of seasoned and knowledgeable professors who write a new installment each week, it's not over the top like the others. It's on top of things. We'll look for you down at the corner of thought leadership and societal impact. Check it out at ProfSpeak.com and stay on top too. Reach for the stars and do it with a WT business degree in hand. For more info, find us at WTMU.edu/COB or call 806-651-2500. From the Texas Panhandle to the world, we're here to help you reach those stars.
At the time of this recording, which is on April 1st, April Fool's Day, we are on the eve of what President Trump is calling Liberation Day. And that has to do with his tariff policies. We're expecting big announcements tomorrow. Investors are sitting on pins and needles, wondering what's going to be said. All we know is that since January 20th, we've heard a lot of talk about tariffs. We've heard a lot of numbers. We've heard a lot of rates, a lot of nations and specific products all specifically picked out. We've seen advances toward the tariff. We've seen people back off. We've heard promises of reciprocity, not a good kind of reciprocity. In any regard, though, tariffs, wow, they're pretty much the story of America, though. We've had tariffs in this country pretty much since day one. They were a big deal throughout the 19th century. In fact, they were the major source of revenue for the federal government until 1913, which is when the federal income tax was implemented. So until then, tariffs averaged about 40%, if you can imagine that. But truthfully, those tariffs were just they were a consumption tax, basically, a value-added tax on imports. What can you tell us about these tariffs and the history of them, Eric?
Well, I think it's important to understand that tariffs are exactly what you said. They're a tax on the importing country, right? So if we import something from Canada and there's a tariff on that good, as Americans, then we are the one who is paying that called a tariff. It's essentially just a tax, right? And so tariffs are taxes. And as you mentioned, in the past, a lot of these tariffs could fund large portions of the going ons in the government. But these days, the government's too big. You can't necessarily fund or even scratch the surface of funding the U.S. government with tariffs. So I'm not sure that's on the table anymore. Nevertheless, some people see benefits. A lot of people see costs of going down this road. It's been tried before with, we can say a mixed bag of success if we're being charitable here. And we'll see. I think the last major Well, what's in everybody's textbooks when they open Econ 101 are the Smoot-Hawley tariffs of the 1930s, right? And that didn't end so well. So I think that's the sort of background that, you know, modern day economists are coming at this issue with.
Well, Smoot-Hawley has often been blamed for the Great Depression.
Well, so it was a I think it was. It's an almost unanimous opinion that it contributed to it. It contributed to it. It made it worse than it had to be.
So tariffs, basically, in addition to being a consumer tax, they are also a form of protectionism. What are we protecting?
Right. So there's always been this, all the way back, and I give this assignment in my industrial organization class, all the way back to Alexander Hamilton, there's been this idea that we can protect infant industries in the country. And in that time, it was protecting the young American industries against the more advanced, cost-efficient British industries. And what we could do then was tax the British goods or subsidize the American goods, however you want to look at it, in hopes of getting them on their feet so that they can flourish. And maybe someday down the road, when they're cost-efficient and they can compete in the market, we can drop the taxes or drop the subsidies or whatever. So that's always been one of the arguments for taxes. The other argument, for tariffs, the other argument is, like you mentioned, it's tax income. So it's another way of finding income from taxation in that sense.
Now, President Trump has endorsed a longtime predecessor, President McKinley, in the 1890s, who also leaned heavily on tariffs as his primary economic policy. But as it turned out, the country went into a pretty serious recession. And by the time McKinley hit his second term, he moderated his views considerably on tariffs. We still had them. Mm-hmm. And remember, we didn't have an income tax yet.
Right.
So they were still a pretty important part. It's just that, you know, things are very different today. We have an income tax. And as much as we may hate to pay it, it is what it is, right?
It is what it is. And I think, you know, when people think of tariffs, they think, okay, well, we're putting tariffs on their tomatoes, they're putting tariffs on our potatoes. And it's as simple as that. But in reality, in the modern economy, if you will, and how many times that phrase has been used, but if you look at how my cell phone is produced or an automobile is produced, some of the manufacturing may be done in the United States, shipped to Canada. Some of the manufacturing is done there, shipped back to the United States, shipped back to Mexico, finally lands on the American, you know, the car lot. And so things are inputs from China, from Canada, from Europe, sent here, sent back. It's hard to tell these days where a good is actually produced at the end of the day. It's not as simple as our potatoes and their tomatoes. And when you start to raise tariffs, one fear is that it's just increasing the cost of these input goods, and it's going to increase the costs all across the board in the economy, which is the fear among economists here.
Now, I remember many years ago when I took international economics, I learned this idea of comparative advantage, and basically says if country A is better or more efficient at producing widgets, and we're better or more efficient at producing thingamajigs, then we should be engaged in trade. We should be sending our thingamajigs to them, and they should be sending their widgets to us. And I know it's an oversimplified example there, and I know how economic theory always looks good on paper, but doesn't always play out exactly the way you want it to. Why have we historically kind of ignored a lot of all that? Because throughout the 1800s and at least the first four decades of the 1900s, the federal government just turned a cold shoulder to that whole idea of comparative advantage. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, comparative advantage is the idea of the person who is relatively more efficient at producing a good should be the one that produced it. So if I were to give a numerical example, right? If I can produce good A good B, both at a cost of 10, and you can produce good A or B at a cost of 1 and 5, respectively. Now everybody's going to write this stuff down, right? You have an advantage in both goods because you can produce both goods at a lower cost. But relatively speaking, I should be producing good B because the comparative advantage lies you have to think about this in relative terms, right? So that's the concept of comparative advantage. And this goes back to 18th century, 19th century thinking about when people first came to the realization that trade is actually good for everybody. There used to be this mindset that winner takes all. There's winners and losers in the economy, and that's that. So let's just conquer that country. Let's hoard the gold. Let's just think about ourselves. But one of the major breakthroughs in economic thought was the realization and the discovery, in some sense, that there's not just winners and losers in the economy. All boats can rise, as I like to say, with fair trade. And that has largely shaped, since then, international trade, although you always have some sort of tendency and some sort of inclination to try to protect your infant industries and find ways to increase the tax base in that way. But for the most part, I think the trend has been towards free trade, but you know, sometimes it doesn't work out that way in practice.
Well, from the 90s on, we had NAFTA, and then in President Trump's first term, we had the MCA trade bill that replaced NAFTA. And we have enjoyed relatively free trade, at least between Mexico, Canada, and us. And there's been a relatively free flow of goods going across the borders. But it looks like that may come to a partial halt, maybe a total grinding halt.
That's what remains to be seen here. I think a lot of people are thinking that these tariffs could be used as bargaining chips and that they're going to go away relatively quickly, that when we raise tariffs, what we're really saying is we want to negotiate and actually bring tariffs down. Because for a long time, you know, countries do have tariffs against us. We have tariffs against them. And one way in which you might hope to bring the tariffs down is to ramp them up and say, look, if you don't bring these things down, then we're going to ramp them up. The fear with using this as a bargaining chip is, in fact, they don't back down and they ramp up as well. And then you get into what we call a trade war or this just escalation process where you get more and more tariffs. Because what's important to consider here is, you know, when we think about this as from a perspective of countries being decision makers, well, we see it. Well, it's just obvious that all these countries just agree to reduce the level of tariffs. But you also have to think about this, and here's where political science comes in and game theory comes in and psychology comes in. Don't think of the countries themselves as decision makers, but the decision makers who are in charge of the country's policies, they have their incentives. And so when we increase tariffs on a specific country or they increase tariffs on us, that elected official in that country on the receiving end of those tariffs doesn't want to look like a wimp, right? They, when we talk about offering a country an off-ramp in terms of like when we think about war and diplomacy, it's the same sort of thing. You raise tariffs on me, well, I'm going to look like a wimp among my voter base if I don't raise tariffs on you, right? And so here you go. And then it's, okay, well, I'll lower them if you lower them. Well, I'm not going to lower them until you lower them. And so you get into this battle of personalities in some sense, and nobody has a political incentive to bite the bullet and be the one to de-escalate the situation. And that's what people are really worried about here.
Yeah, I agree. And again, we're recording this on the 1st of April. By the time this comes out next week, you know, the second week of April, it'll all be old news.
Yeah,
Who knows how many times they will have gone back and forth on it. But from this vantage point, it looks like President Trump is about to make some very important statements, but the EU and Canada are already prepared to counter.
Yeah, I think they're if the tariffs are imposed tomorrow, then we'll probably hear later tomorrow, my guess, and this prediction could be wrong, about some counter tariffs or some response in that regard. And again, that's that first step to escalation, or that second step to however you want to look at it. And that's what people fear. And this ties back into the interest rates that you were talking about, because if these tariffs and we get into this escalatory sort of situation with these countries, and we go back to what I said earlier, the overall costs are going to rise. And as costs rise in the economy, these costs are passed on to consumers. I'm a company who imports a lot of input goods from another country, and the costs of these input goods are suddenly increasing. then I'm going to pass that cost on to some of my consumers, on my consumers through a higher price. And so tariffs in that respect are inflationary. They put upwards inflationary pressure on the economy. And so if we go back to your discussion or our discussion about interest rates, and we ask ourselves, what's the Fed going to do? Are they going to increase or decrease interest rates? Well, a lot of that's going to depend on how this tariff situation plays out. And if these tariffs are going to be inflationary, then we might not get the rate cuts that we were hoping for.
And since these tariffs are basically a tax, they tend to be regressive in that lower income families and persons spend a much higher percentage of their income on consumer items. And so if you're spending 90 to 100%, let's hope you're not spending more than that, you're paying a tax on all of that. Whereas if you're wealthy, you're not spending 100% of your income. You're parking some in a bank account or in stocks or in bonds or something. Mm-hmm. And therefore, your effective tax rate has gone down because you're not consuming as much. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. People who are in a better financial position are probably also in a better position to offset some of these inflationary pressures through outside investments, whereas somebody who does not have as much money to take advantage of investment opportunities are simply going to have to face the brunt of whatever inflationary pressures might come. I heard one estimate that said the 25% tax on cars or foreign-made automobiles could raise the price around $5,000 on average of all these. And so you think about somebody who's trying to buy a car for the first time, and that could be quite a lot of money for somebody who's trying to buy a car. And so that's why I hope that it's not as inflationary as some people are expecting, or that this gets resolved sooner than later.
I have to wonder if there is some thinking that we should be self-sufficient, entirely self-sufficient. In other words, producing all the things that we want to consume. And once again, that may sound pretty good on paper, but can a country really be self-sufficient?
I mean, you can, but you're going to have a lower standard of living. All else equal, and we get into the economic speak now, right? Mm-hmm. If we were self-sufficient, I'm sure we could survive. But would we have the lower prices and the standard of living that we do now? The answer is just flat out no.
I mean, let's put it in simple terms. We like our guacamole.
We like our guacamole.
But right? We can't grow enough avocados in the U.S.
Right.
I mean, the majority of the avocados we grow come from the Central Valley in California. But right. It doesn't begin to touch the demand that we have for our guac.
Right.
I mean, that's
so
all
there is. Guacamole were to shoot up to $25,000 a container tomorrow, some people would be able to afford that, right?
Yeah. Avocado toast would be
right.
Out of the question.
They would be $25,000 avocado toast, but most people wouldn't. Right.
And I guess, in an ideal world, we'd figure out a way to how to plant more of those avocado pits that, come in the middle of each one of those fruits. But they don't grow that fast. They're not
right.
Going to produce avocados for many years.
Right. And so I think the big picture here is how important the interconnected the world economy is. And I don't think there's any country, maybe save North Korea, for which this applies.
I not too long ago, I was grocery shopping, and I went through the produce section with my phone out, and I was taking pictures. Not so much to capture the beauty of an avocado or a tomato in January or February or whatever, but to look for the little sticker that had the country of origin on it.
Mm.
Holy cow, man. And so much of our fresh produce in the wintertime is not from around here.
No.
I mean, we can't, obviously.
Sure.
And while Florida, especially the southern part, may be able to grow a lot of things year-round, they can't support all 340 million of us.
No, right. Florida oranges only go so far. California grows oranges as well. But like you said, a lot of this stuff comes from down south.
Yeah, if you want strawberries or blueberries in winter, you're looking at Mexico for strawberries and Peru for blueberries.
Yeah.
And I found watermelons from Guatemala. And if you want peaches and plums and nectarines, that's from Chile. And
Yeah. No, it's insane. And like I said earlier, a lot of these goods that we buy that are made in America, it would blow your mind to see the production process if you were to follow each part from around the world. And it's just so interconnected, and it's a fascinating topic in international trade. So it's such an important component of our our economy today.
So I guess the real question is, and we have to look at this as academics and be as apolitical as possible, do tariffs work? I mean, and if so, when do they work and when do they not work?
I mean, I guess it depends on how you define work. If you are okay with a little bit more of inflation and you are just need some tax revenue, then maybe you're fine with that. Most economic policies have their costs and their benefits. The question is, are you willing to pay the cost in order to get the benefit that you're looking for? I think most people would argue that there's better ways to raise taxes these days. But then again, if you're using tariffs as a political tool to negotiate better terms, then you might say that it's worth it. So I think a lot of us really don't know the future here, and we're going to see how this plays out.
So I recall from the 1980s when Japanese cars were making major inroads into the American market. Mm-hmm. And we were importing highly fuel-efficient Japanese cars at a time when, even into the 80s, Detroit just couldn't respond that well yet. We still had a lot of, freeway barges and things that. Big cars that were gas guzzlers. And the Japanese were eating our lunch.
Right.
And there were a lot of layoffs at American factories. The UAW wasn't happy. You know, they were not good times to be in the automobile industry, at least here in America. And so what the federal government did under Reagan was something totally different. Instead of imposing big tariffs, they implemented what was called a voluntary quota. Now, voluntary with air quotes around it. It's like,
right.
if you don't do this, if you don't volunteer to do this, then we're going to really stick it to you.
Right.
And basically what they did was they said that, okay, you get this percentage of the market and you're going to divide it up based on market share so that Toyota got the biggest allotment, followed by Honda, then Nissan, and the others. I think there were 9 Japanese automobile makers in the U.S. market at that time. But you know what happened, what it caused? And this is the beauty here. It caused so many of those Japanese car companies to invest in America. They came to the U.S. and built factories. And that's how you wound up with Toyota in Northern California, and ultimately Toyota in San Antonio, Texas here, Honda in Ohio.
In an attempt to get around that quota?
Because you were exempted.
Right.
If you were making your cars here.
Right. Yeah.
Now, they weren't really so picky then about where the parts came from. They were just worried about where it was assembled because in their mind, that was made in America.
Right.
And it worked. It really did. And it helped buy some time for the big three, who are not so big anymore, to catch up and produce some more fuel efficient vehicles and so forth. But in the process, it really changed the industry.
So like you said, there could be these down the road benefits that are hard to necessarily predict from the armchair. And these are definitely things that are worth considering. If these tariffs force companies to start producing in America, then from the perspective of America, that you might count that as a win. So we'll see. But the quota is going to work probably much the same way as the tariff does in effect, because what that does is it's going to restrict the supply side, and in effect it's going to increase the prices on that end. So it's going to make American companies more competitive. So interesting.
I'm sitting on pins and needles myself here as an armchair observer. I want to see what happens here.
Yeah.
And obviously I want the best for America. I mean, you know, that's my citizenship, and I'm rooting for the home team here.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm concerned.
Well, like you said, you're interested to see what's happening. And I think a lot of economists are interested to see what's happening. And, you know, in graduate school, they say, well, one of the difficult things about economics is you can't run experiments like physicists do, right? You can't, you know, physicists can go to drop a particle in a vacuum and see how quickly it, you know, does whatever it's supposed to do. In economics, you can't say, well, let's see what happens to the economy if we set interest rates to 87%. Let's just see what happens. Let's collect some interesting, because you're messing with people's lives, right? But here's an interesting situation that's going to be an extreme sort of scenario where I think a lot of economists are going to say, okay, if there's one benefit to this for us is that we can get some interesting data to see how this plays out.
Back in grad school, my marketing strategy prof, who himself was international and also was an international specialist, said some words that I've never forgotten more than 40 years later. Tariffs are the hallmark of a developing third world nation. He said these words in the early 1980s. Hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think this probably goes back to what you said about the infant industry argument, where a lot of less developed countries are probably more prone to having tariffs just to protect their home country. So that's probably why those two things are associated. So, yeah, that makes sense.
But why are we doing them now?
That's that's above my pay grade.
Yeah. Well, after we come back, we're going to dive into the last contentious topic, and that, of course, is inflation.
All right.
West Texas A&M University has been in the education business since 1910, carrying on a tradition of teaching above all else. And while we made a strong effort to get ahead of the curve in 1997 with our online courses and programs, we never forgot our roots. That's another way of saying we're still rocking it old school with face-to-face classes. Our classrooms in the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business are small by design, so that you can actually get to know your professors and fellow classmates. It's an intimate learning experience, and we offer undergraduate majors in 12 areas. We're double ACSB accredited and among the most elite of business schools around the world. Reach for the stars and do it with a WTBBA degree in hand. For more info, find us at wtamu.edu/COB or call 806-651-2525. From the Texas Panhandle to the world, we're here to help you reach those stars.
Back in 1980, when a mortgage would cost you 16.5% interest rate, inflation was also at 13.5%, just a few points shy, but still, that was outrageously high. And in fact, this was what Ronald Reagan inherited when he won the 1980 election. The tail end of the Carter presidency wound up with high inflation, high interest rates, and high unemployment. Not exactly the things you want to have chasing you as you try to get reelected. So for better or worse, though, I know I did, and my parents suffered through very, very high inflation. Recently, though, our inflation only peaked around maybe 9.5%. And that caught everybody off guard because it was the highest it had been in more than 40 years. But that doesn't mean we should downplay it, because even 9%, that's a lot. And salaries and wages, they're always slow to catch up. What are your thoughts on this, Eric?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think this is funny that we're talking about this today, because just in class today, I was talking about the effects of inflation and why we don't like it for the most part. Now, to have an inflation of zero, think about it as a pulse, right? Think about inflation as a pulse. You don't want, if inflation is zero, it basically means your economy's dead. I mean, nothing's happening, nothing's growing. The central bank shoots for an inflation rate around 2 to 3%. I think it's 2% is their target. So that's what they're going to be liking. That's what they think is healthy for the economy in the long run. Certainly when we talk about 10%, that is much larger than what they would like to see. And I think we experienced, you know, high rates post-COVID. Since then, they've come down a lot. What we talk about, and it's funny because you said 10% and people start to freak out, and I think as well they should, but you're talking about some of the extreme cases in history with inflation. This was post-World War I Germany, and they were having inflation, I mean, off the charts. Prices were doubling almost daily. I mean, it was, I can look up examples, but if we think 10% is bad, think about, you know, your dollar going, losing value by, you know, on a magnitude of billions and things like that, right? So the other extreme case was Zimbabwe in recent history. So compared to those cases, then they'd be laughing at us to think about 10% being bad. But no, 10%, I think, in our day and age is something we want to avoid.
Now, I remember a very oversimplified definition of inflation. Too many dollars chasing too few goods. Mm-hmm. Is that still true?
Yeah. So we can talk about things like the velocity of money, and there's different ways we can, think about inflation. But really, just inflation is just an overall percent increase in the price level. And so, like I said, a certain amount of inflation is good. It means the economy is growing. It's a stable sort of long run trajectory that the economy is on. But yeah, that's essentially Milton Friedman had some sort of saying about money, inflation being everywhere, a monetary phenomenon or something of that nature. So yeah.
So what about in those countries where there has been hyperinflation? I remember too many stories about Argentina, and basically their money wound up being worthless.
Yeah. I could spit out some numbers. I don't want to get them wrong, but I knew some folks from Zimbabwe who said at one point they had trillions of dollars on their bills and stuff like that. And it just becomes paper money. You basically go back into a barter economy because you don't have enough money to, nobody wants it anymore, right? And so instead of saying I'll buy a pair of shoes for $100, it's more like I'll give you my pair of shoes for your shirt or something like that, because that's the only way you can exchange. That's why it's so important to avoid situations like that. In our world, when we think about 10% inflation and that sort of thing, like you said, fixed incomes or incomes that don't adjust as quickly to economic environments or being inflation adjusted, it just starts to slowly erode your purchasing power, your real purchasing power in the economy. And over time, 10% this year, 10% that next year, you start to see a real drop in quality of life.
Now, what about inflationary expectations? This just happened now with the promise of 25% tariffs on imported autos and automobile parts. I heard reports from this last weekend that many people were out shopping for cars in anticipation of those tariffs, which would necessarily drive up the price of a new vehicle. What can you say about those kinds of expectations? It sounds like panic to me.
This is a fascinating topic, and you can write a PhD dissertation on these topics. It's essentially taking the notion of a self-fulfilling prophecy, and students are well aware of this, whether they know it or not. You go into a test, and you think in your mind, "Oh, I'm going to fail this test. I'm nervous. I'm going to fail this test." And what do? You sit there and you fail the test because you've been telling yourself you're going to fail the test. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy in that matter. And there are economic phenomena that are driven simply by these same sort of self-fulfilling prophecies. And so the case that you mentioned is, well, let me go back to a case in my life when I went to, high school back in the day. And one day we go to school and we hear about the 9/11 attacks, right? And we come home and still nobody knows what's going on. And all we know at this point is something bad has happened in the Middle East, right? That's all we know. Or that's all the common population knows. And we say, well, what goes on in the Middle East? Oh, energy prices. Well, what do you think is going to happen? If something bad goes on in the Middle East, what's going to happen to gas prices tomorrow? Everybody expects gas prices to rise, right? So I get calls from family members. We get calls from family members. You better go fill up your gas tanks, because things are going to get crazy. Sure enough, this sort of thought starts to spread throughout society, throughout the United States, and people go fill up their gas tanks. Well, what happens when people go to fill up their gas tanks? The next day, prices do rise, right? So whether or not those attacks were going to directly influence gas prices or not, simply the expectation that gas prices were going to rise forced people or induced them to go to the gas station, fill up their cars, and in fact, gas prices do rise. So it's exactly the sort of phenomenon that you're talking about. Hmm.
And so what do people do to survive when there's inflation going on, but their salaries and wages don't keep up with it? How long does it take to get caught up?
That's a good question. And now we're talking about real incomes, right? And so basically how much purchasing power do I have in terms of the price level? Now we can talk about my nominal wages, and that is the dollars and cents that I make, the number I look at when I look at my paycheck. Then we can talk about my real wages, which take into account the price level in the economy. And so the hope of all economists is that real wages increase so that nominal wages at least keep pace with the increase in the price level or outstrip it in some sense so that your purchasing power and your real purchasing power increases. Problem is when we have high inflation, the price level starts to outstrip the increase in nominal wages. And so while your nominal income might be increasing, your real purchasing power would be decreasing because inflation is starting to eat away at that. And so when you have something like 10% inflation, certainly most people's incomes are not adjusting at a 10% rate a year. And so what we hope to see is we get inflation under control. And then over time, if we can keep inflation steady, it gives time for the nominal wages to catch back up over time. And so that's why we try to get this under control as quickly as possible, because it does have these long run negative effects on real wages.
Now, in the last presidential election, that being last November, of course, both Trump and Harris addressed the issue of inflation. It was the elephant in the living room. You couldn't ignore it. But as we know, one party, one candidate did a much better job of convincing the voters that they had a better solution, and the other not so much. In fact, we tend to blame the guy in the White House for all of our economic problems, whether they can actually control it or not, right. For better or for worse. But we were very much aware that inflation was a problem and it had to be harnessed. But here's my question here. Even if we do harness it, I think a lot of people have this misguided notion that prices are going to go back down.
Right. No. So like I said, the Federal Reserve shoots for around a 2% inflation rate. That does not mean prices are, just because inflation is going down, does not mean prices are going to go back down, right? So inflation is a percent increase in prices. So as long as that is positive, prices are steadily increasing. Now, it doesn't say it does not say we don't have deflationary moments or that prices don't go down, but normally, like you said, there's this misconception that as inflation goes down, that must mean prices are going. It just means that prices are increasing at a slower rate, right?
Right. And yes, to be fair, there are times when prices can go down. Maybe a large retailer is able to negotiate a better deal with a vendor, and then they can pass on some savings. Or perhaps the supply of something could be a component part. It could be an ingredient, whatever. Happens to increase dramatically, and therefore the market for, let's say, cocoa or coffee beans or whatever,
right,
causes the prices of those to go down. But by and large, I'll give you an example. I used to think that a burger in a restaurant that sold for $15 was like overpriced. And now I look at it and think, ooh, that's a bargain.
Yeah, no, our expectations start to adjust as well. So, yeah, things that used to cost, like you said, hamburgers, like, just our perception about what's expensive and what's not expensive just starts to shift ever upwards as we go along.
So what do you think is going to shape the collective memory here as we all get much older? Are we going to be telling stories to our grandkids in two or three decades about, I remember when, you know.
I think about this often. I was born in 1985. So I had a grandfather who, he was possibly going to go over to Japan after, Pearl Harbor. And that was, I think, that generation's sort of moment, World War II. The generation before that, whatever it might have been, World War I or the Great Depression. I think in my generation, that's probably going to be 9/11. And I think that's going to be paired with COVID, I think, is probably going to be the thing that most people look back on and say that was the thing that shaped our times. We try to avoid these things, right? Because it's never, none of these are positive things. So I don't know why it's always negatively shaped. What was a positive thing that we could say, I was around to see? I mean, I guess when airplanes were invented, that generation could lay claim to that. But I don't know. The internet, I suppose, would be a positive mm-hmm. one, or maybe not in terms of the negative effects on that these days. But
and the inflation the inflation rate that we've experienced here the last few years is not necessarily spread evenly across all products and services. Some had more than others, right?
Right. So they break down inflation in different components. You can look at food prices, you can look at energy prices, you can look at all sorts of different components. And the way they weighed inflation is it's an art and a science to figuring out what the price level in the economy is. And they weigh it. One measure weighs it according to, you know, your normal basket of goods. What does the normal person buy? And the way they statistically weight these things can change. You know, what would be in the basket of goods in 1910 or 1905, like a horse and carriage or something like that, would not be in the basket of goods today, right? So you have to sort of adjust to what people are buying. So yeah, you're right. They you can break it down into sector by sector and good by good inflation.
And the fact that that market basket does change makes it kind of difficult to make big comparisons like that, because, you know, let's suppose some particular food product, I don't know, I'm just going to pick on something, say corned beef or whatever. Let's suppose it were a staple item at one time, right, but maybe not so much now. And so they pull it from the market basket. What do they replace it with that makes for an apples to apples comparison?
Yeah, no, that's interesting stuff. That's like I said, I've never directly decided. I don't decide what goes in the basket. Let's say that, but they have their ways and their methods of doing that.
And some categories of products and services have experienced far more rapid inflation than others, and we're a part of one of them. Higher ed has had far more rapid inflation the last 4 or 5 decades mm-hmm. than any market basket of goods.
Yeah. No, I think that's also reflected by the fact that students really want that higher education in order to enter a more ever-increasing job market that demands some of these skills. So I think that's partially reflected simply by the fact that the demand for education has been ever increasing.
Do you think our fears about inflation will ever go away, or is this always going to be something that we talk about at election time?
This is it. This is what we're stuck with.
Inflation. It's the new normal.
I mean, as long as there's economies, as long as there's markets, there's going to be inflation. And I think we're not going to get away with that. We're not going to get rid of that. So better get used to it. Better go take Econ 101 and Econ 102.
Eric, thanks a bunch for joining me here on episode number 50. This has been a lot of fun. I totally enjoy chatting with my economist colleagues, whether it's in the break room or in the studio or in the hallway. It's always fun to talk about econ. And I know you guys get pegged for being the dismal science, but just remember, I always tell my students, if they have any free electives, they need to take more econ, because it's the language of the gods, right?
I wouldn't go that far, but yes,
it explains everything.
It explains everything that we need to know. Exactly.
All right. We'll look for you on the next episode. Meanwhile, it is time to roll the outro. You've been listening to Buff Speak from the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University. Our executive producer is Justin Lovell, and Allison Hunter is our associate producer. Our co-editors are Maverick Evans and Paul Torres. Lindsay Bjork is our director of marketing and outreach initiatives, which includes overseeing Buff Speak. Dr. Jeffrey Babb is Director of Accreditation and is our technical consultant. Finally, Dr. Amjad Abdulat is Dean of the College. You can find us online at wtamu.edu/COB for more information about our programs. Be sure to check out our many academic offerings. Come for the quality, stay for the small classes, affordable tuition, and friendly, approachable professors. And look online at our faculty blog, profspeak.com, for more insights. You can listen to Buff Speak on your favorite podcast portal, as well as on our website, buffspeak.biz. And if you like what you've been hearing, don't be afraid to share us with your friends, colleagues, and family. Word of mouth has always been the best form of advertising. Until next time, love one another. For the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University, I am Dr. Nick Gerlich. And as always, go Buffs! Buff Speak.